to Postcards, a show which takes you across borders without actually leaving home. I'm Wen Jie. A Danish company may have found the answer to housing shortages in major cities. Urban Rigger is a low-cost and environmentally friendly housing solution which uses floating repurposed shipping containers. Here's Bob Jones with this postcard from Denmark.
It may look like conceptual artwork, but this pale blue arrangement of 9 disused shipping containers may be a solution to low-cost housing shortages around the world. Bobbing up and down in Copenhagen Harbour is an Urban Rigger prototype, a unique carbon-neutral floating mobile property. Spread over around 300 square metres, there are 12 individual dorm rooms complete with bathroom and kitchen, a courtyard, barbecue area and communal roof terrace. It's constructed using 9 former shipping containers on a concrete pontoon. Company founder and CEO Kim Laudrup says he was driven to develop a low-cost housing solution for students.
The problem is that all the centralized pieces of land, they are priced at a ridiculous level. And when these things are sold, they're typically sold for office buildings or very expensive condos. So whenever there is a piece of land available in a centralized situation, it just gets too costly.
Laudrup realized the seemingly limitless unused quays, canals and rivers that flow through major cities around the world represented an untapped resource. Repurposing shipping containers into homes became popular in California back in the 70s, but now they've added some high-tech additions. This floating dwelling uses a technology called hydro-source heating, which uses heat exchange from the surrounding water to warm its pipes. Photovoltaic cells on the roof are used to produce clean solar energy. The upcycling of unused or abandoned shipping containers conserves materials and energy. Laudrup claims around 1,100 tons of CO2 are saved when repurposing shipping containers rather than constructing housing using new materials. He says they incorporated lots of practical, environmentally friendly tech into Urban Rigger in an attempt to inspire future generations.
Students, young people, is our future in so many ways. And the fact that they've been able to get a higher education, we need to inspire them to move on with the education. I think that they are the people that are going to solve the problems that that we're facing. So when there's a young boy that is very good at football, he gets a house and he gets a car and he gets all these things, how come we take our students and chuck them into small little 2x4s?
Copenhagen seems a fitting place to start. According to The Economist Intelligence Unit's annual 2016 Worldwide Cost of Living Survey, the Danish capital is the 8th most expensive city in which to live in 2016. That's just behind major financial centres such as London, New York and Paris. Denmark boasts one of Europe's longest coastlines, totalling around 7,300 kilometres. That means Danes can never geographically be more than 52 kilometres from the sea. Frederik Logestrup, vice president of the University of Copenhagen's Students' Union, says there's currently a need for around 10,000 new student housing units in the Danish capital. And that need is only going to increase.
For many students, having a place to live is a constant stress factor in their lives. And, of course, paying a high rent means that you have to work a lot of hours outside studying, and that takes focus away from studying and becoming proficient in whatever you want to study or do.
Logestrup says a higher education, free of rent worries and cramped accommodation, would allow students to concentrate on things that really matter.
I think it would free up a lot of resources for all students and allow them to both become more proficient in whatever they study, and free up some time that they could spend on exploring new areas of research or volunteering and other stuff like that that you really only have the opportunity to really get into when you're a student.
Since completing and showcasing this urban rigger prototype, Laudrup says he's been contacted by interested parties around the world, in the US, the UK and China, to name a few. He says it presents a unique approach to building housing on the water, instead of simply filling in waterways with land.
Every time you use the water as an infrastructure, you typically fill it up with land or with dirt, and then you build on top of it. So you're actually narrowing the blood vessels or the blood veins that built the cities in the first place. So we want to offer this to all the mayors and all the universities, beginning with in Europe, in the harbour and canal-intensive cities.
Laudrup says students could expect to pay between $600 to $800 a month to rent a dorm on board the urban rigger, depending on how much the municipality charges for using the area of water.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn.
Brides and grooms have descended on London for this year's National Asian Wedding Show, and vendors say they're noticing new trends in the Asian wedding market. Here's Christian Schindler with this postcard from the UK.
It's a fairy tale setting for bride and groom. These lavish floral displays are part of the National Asian Wedding Show, the largest event of its kind in Europe. From turban tying services and fashion to catering and design, 195 exhibitors have set up shop here in the hope of winning businesses from couples planning their nuptials. It's a lucrative market. A typical British Asian wedding welcomes several hundred guests and costs an average of £50,000. And of course, very high-end celebrations can have a budget many times that figure. The event design company RWS targets this section of the market. It's not unusual for its staff to re-carpet and even re-wall a venue for a bride and groom before filling it with luxury furniture and accessories, all at an eye-watering cost. But while sumptuous, extravagant weddings are nothing new in the Asian community, RWS manager Nav Bogle says there has been a shift in who makes the decisions.
We've been around for about 12 years now. Our initial consultations always used to be with the parents. It always used to be mum, dad, or an uncle and aunt coming in, sitting down, discussing what they felt would look nice, more so for their friends and family and their guests. And now we've transitioned from that. We're dealing predominantly with the brides and grooms. Predominantly with the brides and grooms that come in, they're much more discerning, they know their taste, they know their styles.
Hosting hundreds of guests means catering on a grand scale. And modern weddings have moved away from a sit-down meal of traditional Asian food, according to catering company Ragamama Ragasan.
Now what we're finding is people are preferring to go towards live-action stations where our chefs can interact with the guests and they can have the actual items tailored to their requirements. We're finding people are mixing up Asian, Japanese, Lebanese cuisine, all sorts of things, all within one setting. So actually, I think it's more because people's tastes are changing. People are preferring to be more adventurous.
As every bride knows, no wedding is complete without the dress. Numerous designers are showing their bridal collections on the catwalk. Indian designer Ravita Mair has brought hers to the UK for the first time. It's not just the women in Asian weddings. The grooms like to be just as well-dressed as their new wives. Mair hopes this show will be the start of a move into the British and international wedding dress market. But she thinks some aspects of design will need to be tailored toward Western clients.
I need to give a blend and a balance between bling and colour, and balance between bling, colour and subtlety. I think in Britain maybe people might like the collection to be subtle, and I also want to not primarily just cater to Indian customers but also British or any international.
Her designs can take months to produce and are manufactured by craftspeople in India. Mair lives in Andhra Pradesh and incorporates the local weaving styles into her clothes. It's a deliberate choice to support traditional skills. An estimated 19,500 visitors will come to this year's National Asian Wedding Show. But what do the brides and grooms think of the goods and services on offer? Aaron Gill is a groom-to-be.
Quite surprised at how many vendors there are from abroad, actually, because we were planning to go and do our wedding shopping all over India. So coming here today has actually opened our eyes to like quite a few other avenues of different vendors that we can use. Quite surprised at how many vendors there are from abroad, actually, because we were planning to go and do our wedding shopping all over India. So coming here today has actually opened our eyes to like quite a few other avenues of different vendors that we can use.
Some people come here to look for the final details to complete their wedding planning. Nishma Shah is a bride-to-be.
We're planning to have like an Alice in Wonderland type theme afternoon party, afternoon tea. So we wanted like, you know, candy cart and chocolate fountain, and there's loads of that here. So that's been really helpful because when you Google it, there's not necessarily that much.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. The sights, sounds, and smells of daily life can be overwhelming, especially for people suffering from sensory overload. It makes simple tasks like a trip to the supermarket a huge challenge. But a new program being trialed in Australia hopes to change that. Here's Zhao Zhenfu with this postcard from Australia.
Others find it a chore, and for a few, it's next to impossible. Mia and Andrew Lester's daughter, Juno, suffers from sensory processing disorder. Noises, smells, and lights, daily life noises to most people, overload Juno's senses.
We don't normally try to attempt it with Juno. It never ends well, so we don't do it with Juno.
We generally avoid anywhere where there's lots of people because there's going to be lots of noise, and especially things like the beeping of the cashiers, anywhere where there's coffee grinders is a big thing for her.
Standing still and talking too long eventually becomes uncomfortable for Juno, and she starts to cry.
And are we stressing her out now?
It's just that we're not moving, I think.
So being here with her family in a big supermarket in Adelaide is a very big thing. It's only been made possible because of a program developed by disability service provider Cara with a supermarket Fruitvale Foodland. It's called Quiet Hour. Amy Noonan is from Cara.
So this is the first Quiet Hour shopping experience in Australia. It is about having the same choices and opportunities as everyone else, not having to single yourself out or to do something special. This is just 1 hour out of the week where we try and make shopping easy for everyone.
The piano player plays his last note. The lights are turned down. The fish shop's cleaned up. The baker stops baking. And even the cash register's ding is turned down. The shopping gets done, but for people like Juno, much more is at stake. It's a step towards independence.
We can't go any further with that until she's able and confident and comfortable in a space like this. So for it to be like this is, it's a golden ticket for Juno.
So far, it's been a 3-week trial, but the hope is that it will prove a real winner. Paul Mubarak is the manager of the supermarket Fruitvale Foodland.
I think we're in it for the long haul. We'll try it for longer and get our customers knowledgeable about the fact that they can have a quiet shop. So my inclination is, yeah, let's give it a go for a bit longer. Yeah.
While the really long-term plan is to introduce the concept around the world, Cara hopes to roll Quiet Hour out to other shops in the area too.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn.
Nepal's best-known Buddhist nun is winning acclaim not only for her charity work, but also her singing voice. Annie Choing Jorma is a pop star nun who frequently travels to the US, Europe, and other Asian countries to give concerts for fans abroad. She uses the money she earns to fund her charitable projects. Here's Wang Jing with this postcard from Nepal.
Maya lu ko
There is one Buddhist nun everyone in Nepal knows by name, and not because she's a religious icon and a UNICEF goodwill ambassador, nor because of her work running a hospital for kidney patients and a school for girls. Annie Choing Droma is famous as one of the country's biggest pop stars. With more than 12 albums of Nepali tunes and Tibetan hymns highlighting themes of peace and harmony, the songstress in suffering robes has won hearts across the Himalayan nation and abroad. But despite her success, the 45-year-old has also attracted criticism from some of the more conservative monks.
They think that a Buddhist nun should be someone who doesn't come out in media so much, who is isolated, doesn't do this, doesn't do that, doesn't say this, doesn't see that, doesn't wear this, doesn't wear this. And always in the monastery, only chanting, shy, not knowing much, you know. But I don't believe in that.
Neither do her fans, who greet her with a round of applause whenever she walks out on stage and fall silent as she closes her eyes to sing. Droma travels the world giving concerts in countries like the United States, Brazil, China, and India. Her fans says she has a unique sound that appeals to many people. One of her concert attendees is Girish Nahati.
It was very tranquil, it was very peaceful. And though I didn't recognize what kind of music it is, but definitely those notes, that singing pattern, it's very tranquil, it's peaceful.
Renu Soman is another fan.
I'm not sure if she's meditating or she's singing. It's a very peaceful, very tranquil kind of voice. The music is also, the type of music is also very calming, very soothing.
Popular composer Nahu Bajachaya, who has worked with Droma, described her music as a fusion of traditional Tibetan and Nepali styles.
When I began composing for her, I mixed Tibetan traditional style with Nepali style. The music for her songs were quite different from any others, and I really cannot exactly say what style of music. But I tried to make fusion with the Tibetan style.
Droma says her singing offers listeners a way to practice meditation and is about invoking a spiritual quality.
I guess I seem to have a little bit of a more melodious voice, so I'm able to carry those melody in more very soothing and melodious way, which I guess people enjoy that. Yeah. And so today I think I'm a spiritual singer, so from the commercial perspective of world.
Droma has refused to say how much money she earns from album sales and concert proceeds, but says she donates much of it to education charities through her Nuns Welfare Foundation. She also funds and runs a kidney hospital. Compared to most Nepalese people living in this poor mountain nation, Droma lives like a star, with a nice car and a new home in an upscale neighborhood in the capital of Kathmandu. Droma was 13 when her mother allowed her to join the Nagi Gomba nunnery to escape from an abusive father. At nunnery, just north of Kathmandu, she learned to chant the Buddhist scriptures. In 1994, American musician Steve Tibbetts visited nunnery and, impressed with her voice, recorded her singing. He returned after receiving interest from U.S. record companies and recorded Droma's first album, Troll, released in 1997. The money from her album royalties and performance fees helps fund this school. Droma used the money to set up an educational foundation and opened Ayatara School on a mountainside just south of Kathmandu. The boarding school offers about 80 girls aged about 5 to 18 free lessons in Buddhist scriptures as well as maths, science and computer skills. The foundation also covers the cost of sending the girls to college.
I really wanted to promote educational opportunities for girls. At least they should have proper support to at least complete their education. Academic education, of course, is there. And as I realized that I have the ability to make money from my singing, I said, why not I use it to fulfill my dream? You know, it always hurts whenever I see that women and girls get less chance.
The students, similarly clad in saffron robes, giggle and smile when they talk about drama. 17-year-old Doma Lamu is now enrolled in college.
Annie is more than my mother. My mother gave birth to me, but Annie raised me, gave me education, took care of me, and this is the only reason that I've reached this far in life.
Joma says it's her work at hospital and school that keeps her singing and accepting invitations to perform.
You're listening to Postcards, a weekly program on events and life stories taking place in different parts of the world. You can listen to our show at newsplusradio.cn. An Australian man is giving away his 2-hectare property on Queensland's Atherton Tablelands, but there is one big catch. The new owners will have to continue caring for the around 1,200 injured or orphaned animals which live there. Before we come to the end of today's show, I would like to share with you an extra postcard from Australia. If it's wild, from the tropics, and has been injured, chances are animal sanctuary owner and operator Harry Kunz has cared for it. Eagles Nest Wildlife Hospital, around 130 kilometers south of Cairns, claims a 78% survival rate for its rescued animals.
From koala to cassowary to emus to dingoes to parrots, any kind of birds, marsupials, you name it, you know, from little rats to lizards.
They treat more than 1,000 each year at a cost of around 60,000 Australian dollars, or some 45,000 US dollars. Khan says it's money well spent.
There is nothing better in my experience in life than to save a helpless, voiceless animal that cannot help himself, etc. What is there better, you know? You get him injured, you fix him up and so, and then a couple of weeks, months later, you can release him back in the wild.
But at almost 70, the wildlife carer says he's now too old to continue and is looking for a successor to continue his work. He'll even sign over the deeds to this 2-hectare property for free, but the animals are part of the deal. The wildlife hospital says it's already received dozens of offers to take over the property, but Khan says it's not for everyone. They're looking for someone very specific.
We need the passion and the love for our wildlife, you know, our animals, and for our environment.
Everything else, Khan says, he can teach. With that, we wrap up today's postcards. For program producer Zhao Jianfu, I'm Wen Jie. See you next week.